Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to The Tonight Show. The government announces a major immigration shakeup with plans to speed up asylum applications and provide thousands of state-owned beds for asylum seekers.
We need to move beyond the emergency response to the migration crisis and try to get to a planned and sustainable system. And really, I see the two proposals being brought forward by my colleagues today as an important step in that direction.
Also on the programme, the Taoiseach confirms that Ireland is set to intervene in South Africa's genocide case against Israel over Gaza. And local authorities will be granted the power to introduce traffic congestion charges. But do they actually work? The government is set to opt in to a new EU asylum and migration pact. The move, which requires Oireachtas approval, is being taken in an effort to improve screening and security checks and speed up application times for people seeking asylum in Ireland. Announcing the decision today, the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, said the EU-wide solution would help reduce the secondary movement of applicants already processed elsewhere into Ireland.
We will have a more comprehensive returns policy, which will be of particular benefit to Ireland, as so much migration here involves secondary movement, in other words, people who have already either sought or been granted asylum in other member states. And it will also provide for a more enhanced security checks so that we can identify at earlier stages someone who might be a risk.
Well, this came as the government announced a major shake-up of the asylum system, which aims to provide 14,000 state-owned beds and move away from the reliance on accommodation in hotels, guest houses and other properties. Joining me to discuss all of this are Fianna Fáil MEP Barry Andrews, Sinn Féin TD Matt Carthy, Independent TD Matty McGrath and political editor of the Daily Mail Craig Hughes. We're also joined down the line from Brussels by Eve Geddy, European Director with Amnesty International. You're all very welcome along to the programme tonight. Barry Andrews, I want to come to you first and talk about this EU Asylum and Migration Pact, which the government wants to opt in on. What does this entail for Ireland? Because there are several aspects to it. Can you explain what they are and why the government is in favour of opting in?
Yeah, well, it's 10 years in gestation and agreement was arrived at between the European Parliament and the Council in December. And it covers every single aspect of the migration journey, from coming to the border through how you're treated within any of the member state countries to the process of the consideration of your application and your return if your application is unsuccessful. So it provides binding timelines. In some cases, it makes it harder to make an application for asylum. And there are also a level playing field, I would say, so that there isn't a tendency for secondary movements. And that's been a huge issue for Ireland. We've seen a lot of people coming from safe EU countries to apply for asylum where they've already received asylum in another country. So this asylum pact will give us an opportunity at an EU level to tackle this issue once and for all. There has been a lot of criticism of the failure of the European Union to properly tackle this issue. So finally, we have agreement across all the 27 member states. We have agreement at the European Parliament. We'll vote on it now in Brussels. And of course, Ireland has the unusual position of having to opt in or not. By and large, we've opted in these areas of migration and asylum in the past. And I think it is the right decision for us to do that.
Is it a tightening up of the migration system? I mean, from everything you're saying, that's what it looks like.
Well, I've spent a lot of my life, you know, articulating and advocating for people on the basis of migrant rights. And I have to say that I've reached my pain limits in terms of what this contains. I have some worries about it. There's been a lot of NGO criticism about it, about the treatment of people at the border, about the fact that there's no EU-led search and rescue in the Mediterranean, about the treatment of children in particular at the border and vulnerable people, about the circumstances of returning people to countries where they may not be safe. So there are criticisms there, and I've really wrestled with my conscience on this, but I think if we don't have this pact presenting to the people across Europe, we have 450 million people in the EU, we've got this important election, and I think in the next European Parliament, there'll be no chance of getting agreement on something like this. It's taken 10 years to get to where we are, and I think it's the best we can settle for.
OK, but you're wrestling with your conscience over this, so there are aspects of this that you feel, from a humanitarian point of view, you're not comfortable with.
Yeah, well, like I said, I've been arguing for search and rescue, EU-led search and rescue in the Mediterranean for quite a long time, and there was a negative vote in the European Parliament in 2019. Together with other MEPs, I led a resolution that reversed that. I was hoping that in this migration asylum pact we would have an EU-led search and rescue, but we don't. But what we do have, I think, is a balance between, on the one hand, providing for secure, safe and legal pathways for those who are fleeing a well-founded fear of persecution in their country of origin, but also restoring public trust that we have a robust system of migration management across the European Union.
All right. Matt Carthy, your party is saying that the vast majority of measures contained within this pact are not in Ireland's interest. Why?
I think it's really important to understand that migration policy, asylum policy, is an issue in many respects of sovereignty. And as with all matters of sovereignty, I think there has to be a very strong rationale for ceding that sovereignty. Ireland is one of two states that has an opt-out of these, and we have that for very good reason. And in my view, we should protect that opt-out. Remember, with any of these regulations, once we opt in, okay, we can't opt out.
So what there should we be opting out on?
So what we should be to turn that on its head, what we should be opting into are those mechanisms, those regulations. So two out of the seven regulations that will come before the European Parliament, I believe, are worthy of consideration for Ireland to opt in. They are the regulation in respect of EU-wide policy, so the right of states to return asylum seekers who have already been in another European state and claimed asylum.
The secondary movement issue.
There. And the second issue is the Eurodac, the sharing of information essentially to ensure that there is adequate checks and balances.
So a fingerprint database.
All of that. In those instances, I absolutely agree that they are worthy of consideration for opt-in. In all other instances, in terms of the other five regulations, there is nothing contained within that Ireland can't do at a domestic level,
like,
and we should take that. So, for example, there's a common set of standards to be applied in terms of the rights, entitlements, conditions in which asylum seekers should be accommodated. One of those is the right to work, for example. So the new regulation, by the way, which we hadn't previously signed into the last one, changes the criteria from 12 months to 9 months. Ireland already has a criteria of 6 months in that respect. And that's the same across the board. So in other words, in Ireland, people can seek work if they're seeking asylum once they've been in the state for 6 months. The new regulation at the European level would set that bar at 9 months. So we're already going beyond what this regulation is. And all of those issues are best determined at a national level. The other problem I have...
So you're taking a kind of a pro-migrant view on that one when it comes to their ability
to work. No, what I'm saying, I'm taking
right?
a pro-sovereignty view. I'm saying decisions in these matters, when they are best made at national and local level, that's where they should be made.
Are we making them well at national and local level right now?
No.
All right, so what's Sinn Féin's big plan if you're talking about an overhaul of the system?
OK, well, let me say this. Under if these regulations apply today, we would still have migrants sleeping on the streets. We would still have the debacles of hotels being taken over, and we would still have this government mismanaging the entire situation. The only addition we would have is potential fines from the European Commission. So the Irish people, as well as having to deal with an incompetent government dealing with these things, would also have to pay the European Commission for the privilege of that incompetent government.
All right, so you're saying if we opt out of certain aspects of this, which we're entitled to do, so we can agree, mixed bag, and we can pick and choose, essentially, then, you know, we're not...
Which is what we have done.
Liable.
What we have always done.
All right.
Ireland has opted in to previous mechanisms such as the Dublin regulations and has opted out of those areas where the policies are best determined at a national level.
All right. And I'm still not, and we might get to it, I'm still not entirely clear, apart from the issue of the ability of an asylum seeker to work and how long they must be in the country in order to do that. What else you're opposed to on it?
But no, just well, what I'm saying back... is I'm opposed to making agreeing to very rigid procedures at an EU level when at a national level we have the flexibility to do everything that's contained within them, if that's what we wish, to go beyond, to go to not go as far.
So
but the decision will be made by elected representatives in Ireland in a flexible and a manner that allows us to respond to situations as they evolve. If we adopt this rigid regulation, then that ties the hands of future governments to actually respond to future crises.
OK, Barry, on that, if we can opt in and opt out of various parts of this, do we need to take, you know, do we need to be all in here? Sounds like we don't.
Like a sovereignty is a principle or it's not. You're either... It's sovereignty offends against every principle, every one of these pieces of legislation, or you're in favour of all of them. And Sinn Féin...
Is that the way it works?
Sinn Féin introduced their opposition. This is an each-way bet by Sinn Féin. They're trying to have it both ways, right? They're in a bit and they're out a bit. It's either sovereignty or it's not. You introduced this in your statement earlier today. Sinn Féin's statement is Sinn Féin are opposed to open borders. Yes. Now, Mary Lou McDonald was specifically asked about this phrase, open borders, because people will be familiar with the take back control, what we hear from the Tories in the UK. And Mary Lou said back in December, not years ago, I'm talking about in December, I hear sometimes people don't want this open borders thing. What is that? I mean, nobody has that. She correctly pointed out that there is no such thing as open borders. If there were open borders, people wouldn't be drowning in the Mediterranean. So Sinn Féin are trying to have it both ways. They're talking out of both sides of the mouths. This is flip-flop, just like on hate speech and the referendums and defence, on a whole range of topics. And if people are fooled by Sinn Féin's sudden conversion since last December to a policy of in favour of, against open borders, suddenly
the phrase that was used in the statement is taken directly from the Sinn Féin manifesto in 2020. It's interesting that Barry hasn't tried to defend handing over and ceding sovereignty in 5 of the 7 regulations where it's absolutely not necessary. Yet in some instances, we have been very clear in terms of our approach to the European Union. We have always said that there are some areas that you need to operate and coordinate with other member states. And in those instances, that's where power should be devolved to the European Union. But other areas are better determined.
Before we move on, can I get an answer? Can we opt into some and opt out of other parts of this?
We can.
That's fine. Yes. Matty, to bring you in on this, what's your main objection to the pact? Do you believe it will bind us to certain commitments?
Of course I do. And it's interesting that we're here thanks to Lisbon too. When the people again spoke in Lisbon and rejected the government's proposals, and under Lisbon too, under Article 29.4.7 of the Irish Constitution, this is very clearly there, that we must discuss this by both houses of the Oireachtas, and I think that's vital. And it's meant to be signed by the end of March. The door is not back till the 7th. So, like everything else, the government just, we're going along and a jolly on this, we're going to just sign it up like they've signed to most things. Except for they got such a walloping in the referendum.
So it will go before the Justice Committee and then it will be discussed.
We taught that today, thankfully.
By the Houses.
But as I said...
My issue is, refers to payments, does it?
Well, money is number one. I mean, 20,000 per person that we don't refuse to take per annum. That's not a finite figure. We don't know how many or whatever.
It's not 20,000 per annum. It's 20,000 per person.
Per person per annum, I understand.
No, per person.
Well, I was told today it was per annum, so I don't. That has to be clarified.
Can you explain what that is? That's if we are overwhelmed as a country, or we decide not to take.
We decide not to take them. We have to pay 20,000 per person.
Migrants.
I understood per annum. Barry says it's not, but I don't know how long it is for. But I understood it's per annum. We're already paying a billion this year in 2024 of Irish taxpayers going to cost to house, to deal with the IPES situation and housing of these people. And God help us, many of them are genuine people and they're coming from war-torn areas. But the big problem is here. Barry is saying now that the Parliament took 10 years to come up with this. This election on the horizon, you know, makes people think all of us, and they're acting very fast now. They're out of touch with the people. And the Taoiseach has stood down and said he was no longer the right person to lead the country. But extrapolate from that, this government is no longer fit to lead the people, and they shouldn't sign this without putting it to the people. Well, the debate in the Parliament, they have a majority. Sinn Féin will be playing...
To put this particular pact to yes, the people?
Yes, because the people are angry and cross. And
in what capacity?
Everyone you talk... Sorry?
In what way? In a
I'm just saying, either go to the people when have an election or else put it to the people in a plebiscite, because people are furious about going on, not being listened to, and they're not being listened to here again. And that's the simple fact of it. And we can have semantics between Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil. When it comes to they're all in the one global vote, as far as I'm concerned. And it's shocking, but the people are furious, and they're waiting for Barry and his colleagues and everybody else in the long grass, as I said. But
can I ask you, Matty? From what we're hearing about it, is it not a tightening up?
Of the migration system, too little, too late
to introduce a more robust
too
system.
Too little, too late, but again, by eroding our sovereignty. That's the main problem with this. We have the right, thanks to the people who voted twice in Lisbon, and they got these concessions.
Would you be voting against this migration pact?
I will, of course, because we're ceding too much of our sovereignty, and our policy is totally...
Do you think we're able to do it on our own?
Sorry?
Do you think we're able to do it properly on our own?
Under articles, there's opt-out clauses.
There's a country,
and the government just opt-in.
Matty, there's a country that has tried to do this by itself, and it's our next-door neighbour, the UK. So since they left the European Union, their net migration has increased dramatically to figures not seen before in the UK. They have tried to take back control of their borders, and it demonstrates to anybody who's willing to look that you cannot do this on your own. This is a European problem. What we're trying to do here is to provide a fair system that is also firm to restore
public confidence. Why were we so slow? Like, how many safe countries do we have recognised?
The UK have tried this sovereignty thing.
And now we're admitting that people are coming here from other countries where they have been already. That's been pointed out. And I'm glad we're having this debate, because we couldn't have this debate.
Would this mean that there's an EU-wide database of safe countries, say, and that then Ireland goes along with that as distinct from defining safe countries ourselves?
Look, this is a tightening up of asylum rights here.
How many safe countries are we going to have?
We have, I think, 12. I don't have a problem with safe countries of origin, by the way. I don't have a problem with expanding it. What I have a problem with is the externalisation of the outsourcing of the assessment of asylum to places like Libya and Tunisia. I have no problem with extending it to Algeria and Botswana.
You may be at odds with Fine Gael colleagues on that one.
No, I don't think so. I think, judging
from what your comments on it when it was the EPP in the party's manifesto about a safe third countries, you were saying, you know, that it's not in order to, I suppose, conquer the right, you don't move to the right.
But if we have
safe and legal colleagues.
So if we have safe and legal pathways, and we also have a firm system of making sure that those who apply for asylum and aren't successful are returned to their countries of origin, if we have that in place, then we don't have to have the system of outsourcing and externalising.
So you're not in favour of autocracies like Tunisia.
That isn't the pact. That was, I asked that question. So it was that issue of safe third countries in the pact. It is. And while Minister for Justice Helen McEntee said today that isn't something Ireland is looking at yet, I think that is perhaps the most worrying aspect of this migration pact. The fact that we could outsource the asylum process to a country outside of Europe. We saw the deadly impact that had when Libya was used, and it shouldn't be repeated again. But just to go back on Sinn Féin's position.
Just to explain this to people briefly, are we looking at a sort of a European style Rwanda plan? Is that essentially what?
For example, Italy have a deal with Albania at the moment, whereby rather than asylum applications be processed in Italy, 30,000 a year they estimate will be processed in Albania. That's a very worrying departure when you start outsourcing something so crucial like that outside of Europe's borders.
All right. OK, I want to bring in Eve Geddie, European Director with Amnesty International at this point. Eve, thank you for joining us on the programme. Amnesty also opposed to this pact from a migrant perspective. You say if we're looking for a system that's fair and safe, this pact is not the solution. Why not?
Well, in our view, Claire, I mean, compromise cannot come at the cost of human rights. And, you know, for years, the EU has been trying to reform its asylum migration policies. But in Amnesty's view, this pact, as it stands, will actually worsen the situation. We think it will create more chaos and also set EU asylum laws back for decades. With this pact, what we're going to see is more people stranded, detained or destitute along Europe's borders. There'll be a lot more detention, including families and children behind barbed wire fences. We're going to see fewer legal protections for people, meaning that many claims will be unfairly rejected. A lot more people deported to countries where they have no connections and they may not even speak the language. And while these standards are low, the pact even allows EU member states to suspend them for what they consider an emergency, such as increased arrivals. And as Amnesty, we've seen these types of measures being abused, for instance, in Latvia and Lithuania in 2021, where they claimed a state of emergency, which denied access to journalists, to humanitarians, to NGOs, to the borders, where the governments detained people there without any kind of process, or abandoned them in sub-zero temperatures in the forest, resulting in extreme suffering and even death. So, and in Latvia and Lithuania, these so-called exceptional measures are still in place. So, I mean, this is kind of the exceptions that have been given to member states, which are now codified in the pact. But I think we also have to be clear, in recent years, we have seen what Europe can do. We've seen what the EU 27 can do when they unite and when they put fairness and humanity first, and they deal with people at its borders and in its towns and communities in a fair way. Let's not forget the EU and Ireland was exemplary, really, in showing a really good response to Ukrainian arrivals and what 27 can do when they work together. In our view, the pact was an opportunity to learn from these lessons, move away from tried and failed policies, and show that Europe together can cope.
I want to ask you, though, Eve, what do we do? Like, it's accepted that it's a challenge that is facing the EU right now. You're saying Europe has shown what it can do. So, I mean, what can it do in this instance? And we know the problems that we're seeing here in Ireland and the push for, I suppose, greater control or at least management of our system right now. So how do you do that if you're going to reject this pact?
Well, what we need to see is really credible options like, you know, refugee resettlement, you know, humanitarian visas, other safe and dignified pathways. The EU is the 27 together. I mean, that's really quite unique in the world. Looking at an issue like migration, those states can come together and have a sustainable asylum migration system which respects human rights. We need to see, I mean, the issue was mentioned already on the panel about the lack of search and rescue, for instance, in the pact. We also need to see more investment in asylum reception systems. We need to see really strong measures to address violence and impunity against migrants at the borders, and measures which are upholding right to asylum, not downgrading it. I think for Amnesty International, we really want to be clear about, we've been really clear about the human rights risks in the pact, and we'd want to see Ireland setting a better and more humane standard in response to migration. Any laws that are brought in really must comply to human rights, and I think here what we need to see is close monitoring, sufficient funding for reception, full access to legal support and safeguards, and also avoiding detention or deportation to countries where people's rights are at risk.
All right. OK, Barry, to bring you in on that, and we've heard a long list of concerns there from Amnesty, and it's interesting because you're getting it from both sides. You're getting it from those who say, you know, we should make our own calls. It shouldn't be Europe deciding how we, you know, manage controls and manage our migration system. And then from a humanitarian perspective, that this is going to lead to more suffering and more misery by migrants.
Well, like I said at the beginning, we're trying to strike a balance because on the one hand, there are those who
are
say...
Are you losing a post?
Well, I don't think so. I think we now have agreement at the European Parliament level, and it is agreed at the EU's 27 level as well with the member states. And it's taken an awful long time to get where we are now. And it's not perfect. Don't get me wrong. And a lot of what Eve has just said are issues that I've been raising in the European Parliament. But it's the best we're going to get.
Why are those issues being ignored?
We have been able to introduce a number of safeguards. For example, there's no child, a vulnerable, unaccompanied child will go through a fast-track system. So if you come to the border and you're from a designated safe country of origin and you manifestly have no opportunity to be successful in your application, you will go through a fast-track procedure. That won't happen for children. There will be individual assessments as well. Lots of safeguards in the proposals.
Let's bring on another aspect of the government announcement today, and that was, I suppose, in the here and now, but actually looking at a more long-term view of the asylum accommodation situation. Craig, you know, this move away from reliance on private providers to state-owned accommodation, this has been the promise for some time. Is there anything new in today's announcement?
Well, we did get some certainty around the figures of it. And what the...
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Grandpan is, I think what people will be concerned about is we've had lots of aspirations before that weren't delivered on. I even think back to January, for example, when the Taoiseach promised we'd have 10 designated areas, districts that would get special treatment. Didn't happen, fell by the wayside. Today, there was a key promise, you know, that we would have 14,000 state beds for asylum seekers delivered in the next 4 years. And I think 7,000 of those within 18 months. But the problem for this government has been so far has been the issue of delivery. Like, we're told that modular housing will be part of this. But if you look back to the delivery of modular housing when it came to Ukrainians, I think we were promised 700 in June 2022. We've only got about 310 of that so far. So the issue will be delivery. And can the government live up to this white paper?
OK, Matt, on that, big promises, I suppose, in increasing the number of state-owned accommodation and then the whole idea of refurbishing office units so that asylum seeker applicants can move in there. What's your view of the government attempt to increase the amount of accommodation available?
Well, I think the announcement of a so-called plan today just crystallises the fact that there has been no plan, and where there have been aspirations, as Craig has said, they've been missed. Widely, the government have been, you know, I've said it here before, if you are trying to make a shambles, if you are trying to antagonise local communities, if you are trying to design a system to fail, you couldn't have done a better job than what this government have put in
is
place.
Is this not a semblance of a plan now?
Well, I recall having debates in this studio, I think, you know, 10 years ago, if not a little bit less, in respect of the reliance on private operators in terms of direct provision and the commitment of that stage by government that they were going to move away from that. We have a situation here today where there are a small number of individuals and companies that are making an absolute fortune on the back of government incompetence. And what you have now is that antagonisation of local communities, this hostility now to any notion, which didn't have to be the case. In terms of people opposing the locations for centres of asylum, and the goodwill that was there within a lot of communities has been lost. So I think for government, the proof is very much going to have to be in the delivery. And I have to say, I have no confidence whatsoever that the current parties of government have the wherewithal to actually turn this around. And the evidence is in the fact that today we have hundreds of people sleeping in our capital city and in other towns and villages across the country. That's the evidence that this system is broken.
I want to bring Matty in on this. The government would say about the situation of people sleeping rough that this is a response to that, to ensure that people are not in tents on the side of a street, that they are in accommodation, however temporary that accommodation is.
Sure, Matt is saying that he's no confidence in the government to do this. I have no confidence in the government's three parties or the fourth wing of government, which Sinn Féin have become, when so many issues in the dog, including this issue. We were stood steadfastly refused a debate on this for the last 15 months inside the Dáil chamber. No debates on it. It's just they've all signed up to the same pact. I have no faith in this whatsoever because they're not going to deliver. How come they couldn't do anything like this to leave their own 14,000, including 4,000 children, homeless, that they couldn't provide these state centres or take over office blocks or whatever? This is not going to happen because there's no capacity in the construction industry, number one. The government don't even know where these sites are going to be. Again, there's huge speculation. I'm told we're getting one in my own county in Clonmel, but there's all cloak and dagger carry on going on. No consultation, absolutely none, with people. This is ham-fisted. The problem is, as I said, they're going to take up to 16,000 a year for the next 14 years, according to the minister today. The numbers are too high. We just can't cope with them. Let's be realistic. Look at my glass of water. That only takes so much water. You fill it over, it spills over. So it's not rocket science. And the government are going from one crisis to the next with their supporters in Sinn Féin, and the people are angry. Very angry, and been more angry by this after speaking out so strongly 3 weeks ago in the referendum, to be dosed with this again by government. They're totally out of touch.
OK, 2028, I mean, realistic. Like, we've been talking about this and people have been asking for a plan for some time, Parry.
Yeah, well, we have a European plan we've just discussed and it's taken an awful long time. We now have a plan in terms of state accommodation and trying to move to those things. And we need to do the communication better, and we need a budget around this plan. It doesn't mean anything if it's just...
OK, well, it's your government's plan.
Yeah, well, that's
OK, we'll have to leave it there. We have to take a short break now. My thanks to Eve Geddy. The others are staying on. Coming up next, confirmation that Ireland will intervene in South Africa's genocide case against Israel over Gaza. Stay with us. Welcome back. Ireland is set to intervene at the International Court of Justice in a case being taken under the Genocide Convention by South Africa against Israel. The case will determine whether Israel is committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. The Taoiseach Micheál Martin had this to say going into Cabinet this morning.
South Africa has yet to table its substantive memorial, and that will be some months away yet. But in the meantime, we're satisfied from... first of all, the legal work that has been done, and also the rapidly deteriorating situation in Gaza, which is a humanitarian catastrophe now. And where clearly aid is being prevented from going in, where the most vital essentials of life are being prevented from going into the people of Gaza, that this constitutes significant harm and destruction.
Well, I'm joined again by my panel of Barry Andrews, Matt Carthy, Matty McGrath and Craig Hughes. Barry, Ireland will be intervening there. We heard from the Taoiseach that. How did the government come to that decision to join South Africa's genocide case against Israel?
Well, there were a number of things. First of all, there was a Dáil motion which encouraged the government to consider adding its name to the case being taken against Israel. Secondly, the government took legal advice from its own legal advisers, as well as the South African Foreign Ministry, as to the type of intervention it could proceed with. And as the Taoiseach had just pointed out, thus the conditions for an intervention now have been passed so dramatically. And we see it every day in our news feeds, on our newspapers, on our screens, the horrors that the people of Gaza are enduring. I was down there myself very, very briefly at the border at Rafah. And we saw some of the people that have come out of Gaza and the trauma that they've experienced. Some of those that were let out by the Israelis, I expected them to be in happy mood, but they're all traumatised. Who they left behind, what they saw, and the unknown future ahead of them, but they're the lucky ones that got
out. In saying that the conditions have now been passed, in saying that, are we saying now that Ireland believes that Israel is carrying out genocide in Gaza?
I think that... in my own view, is that it is the conditions for genocide. For example...
Is that what Ireland is saying by intervening in this case?
Yeah, and I think we have to choose our words.
This is genocide.
We have to choose our words very carefully. An overwhelming majority of the International Court of Justice, in its provisional measures in January, found that Israel was deliberately blocking aid, and that is causing starvation. And the foreign minister of the European Union, Josep Borrell, said that starvation is being used as a weapon of war. And there was an order that South Africa should provide for immediate and effective access for international humanitarian aid into Gaza. In fact, aid has fallen by 50% since that
time. So is the government's official line now is that this is genocide?
It will be a matter for the International Court of Justice to make that finding.
OK, but that's what South Africa...
And we are joining this case because we believe that...
And we're joining that case.
Yeah, we are joining that case. We believe the conditions...
So is that what Ireland is saying?
We believe the conditions are there to join this case, to make the case against South Africa. I personally believe that it looks like genocide to me, But I do respect the International Court of Justice.
But if I'm trying to understand yeah. it. If we are saying that we are joining and intervening in South Africa's case of genocide against Israel, is Ireland's official stance now is that it believes that what is happening in Gaza is genocide?
Look, my own view is that that's the case. The legal advice we've got is that it is possible for us to intervene in this. That the
saying it's genocide.
That we are supporting the case that's been taken by South Africa. Right. But it's ultimately a matter for the International Court of Justice to make that finding.
Matt, are you clear on this?
So, first of all, I welcome that there is now a statement of intention to intervene in this case. As you know, Sinn Féin brought forward a motion calling on the government to intervene several months ago. Government actually amended that to change it to intervene, to urgently consider intervening. I think what's really important now is that that intervention is meaningful. And what I mean by that is that we have to be very clear that we are supporting South Africa's contention that Israel is in breach of the Genocide Convention. In other words, that it is guilty of genocide. That's how you intervene in support of an application brought before the court. I think the declaration needs to be made quickly. I think it's important to note, possibly coincidentally, that this is the week that the UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese actually name-checked Ireland as a state that has been saying the right things in respect of Palestine, but not taking any actions whatsoever. She described that as shameful. I think
what would you expect, sorry, point.
So there's a number
next
of...
step to be the, now.
So there's a number of things government could and should be doing. The first is in respect of the ICJ case. And as I say, I welcome that and I hope that the intervention is a meaningful one. I think the Irish government should reconsider their position in respect of the International Criminal Court case, which has basically ran aground because the special prosecutor isn't moving fast enough. The Irish government should also free up the Sinn Féin bill, the illegal Israeli settlements divestment bill, which would actually prevent Irish taxpayers' money being invested as it currently is in companies that are profiting from the illegal settlements. We should also enact the Occupied Territories Bill, and we should also recognise the state of Palestine. We have to. We have an obligation internationally. We see a genocide unfolding before our eyes. States like Ireland that are on the right side in terms of their rhetoric need to follow up with the right steps in terms of actions against the Israeli regime.
Matty, will it be getting sort of cross-parliamentary support?
I'd imagine so. And what I can't understand is, you know, this intervention today is welcome, but how long is it going to take? I mean, ICJ is still months away, we believe, from bringing his case forward. Goodness, we can see the TV screens. We can hear the interviews. I heard somebody yesterday who was out there and went, God, the stories about the children dying in pain and agony for the want of medicines and drugs. And to stop food going in. So we've always been good in this country to help in humanitarian situations. So I can't understand the slowness of the case that South Africa is putting this motion together. What's keeping it? I mean, they'll be wiped out before action is taken. So we need to, yes, as a neutral country, we need to be saying, look, yes, the error on the side of right here, it looks like genocide. Sure, it is genocide. And I totally, utterly condemn what Hamas did as well. That was horrific. And many of the debates by Sinn Féin and others are completely one-sided as well, and ignoring the awfulness of what Hamas did and continues to do.
Briefly, Craig, would we expect more clarity on this from the government, or more than just the doorstep? Micheál Martin had before going into cabinet this morning.
Yes, so we had a quick briefing after cabinet with some of the spokespeople. They were quite clear in saying that Ireland was entering not to take sides, but to be part of the case. And I think Solanish was quite clear in his language, actually quite strong, that he did view what was happening as a blatant violation of international humanitarian law.
All right, OK, there we'll leave that discussion for now. My thanks to Barry Andrews, to Matt Carthy, Matty McGrath and Craig Hughes. Congestion charges could be on the cards for tackling traffic in our cities, but do they actually work? We will debate that issue next. Welcome back. Local authorities will be granted the power to introduce a traffic congestion charge as part of new plans signed off at Cabinet today. The charge, which is already in several major cities, would require motorists to pay a daily rate for driving into the city centre. It's part of a new government strategy to improve the transport system and to reduce carbon emissions by making people less reliant on using cars in cities. But will it actually work? Well, joining me to debate the move are Dublin Green Party councillor Michael Pidgeon and Geraldine Herbert, motoring editor with the Sunday Independent. You can have your say with our live interactive poll tonight. We're asking, should cities introduce congestion charges to improve sustainability? You can vote online on virginmediatelevision.ie/vote, or you can follow the QR code that's on the bottom of the screen, and we will bring you those poll results later on in the programme. To come to you first, Michael Pidgeon, your Dublin City Councillor, you believe we do need to curtail the amount of traffic coming through our city, and congestion charges are the way of doing that.
I think it's one of the ways. It's probably one of the last methods I'd use. I'd love to improve public transport, accessibility, cycling and walking options, that sort of thing first. But as we've seen with cities that even have public transport networks that are light years ahead of us, like London or Singapore or Stockholm, sometimes there is still, unfortunately, a nub of congestion that gets in the way of improving the core city centre that you need, unfortunately, not a carrot, but a stick for. So I'd love to hopefully eliminate congestion through positive measures by making it easier for people to cycle, walk, better trains, better buses, faster buses, that sort of thing. But there comes a point, unfortunately, where there's just a bit of congestion that you cannot get rid of. And that really, really, I think, drives people nuts. Because if you live on a street with congestion, it's almost by definition not going to be a nice place to live because it's so crowded with so much traffic.
Well, haven't we come to the point that we don't just have a small niggle of congestion, we have an awful lot of congestion. So you're introducing it now when people would argue that the public transport systems aren't really in place and there aren't those alternatives that we have in cities like London.
Yeah, well, I think the first thing to note is that this is a plan and a document to make future legislation to then give councils the power to do something in the future if they want to do it. So I don't think it's congestion charges coming in now. But I think we do have to take a lot of steps to improve things like public transport first. But then once we get to that point, if we're still facing hard congestion, congestion that could well be actually blocking public transport like buses, then unfortunately we might be at that point, as other cities like London, Stockholm, Singapore that I mentioned have had to do.
OK, so what Michael's saying, Geraldine, is that this is a last resort, but we may come to the point that, you know, it's now time to see city councils want to introduce it, then they will be able to do so.
Yeah, look, I have to say I would be against congestion charges. I think they're a very blunt instrument. They obviously have much greater impact on those on lower incomes than higher incomes because of the nature of how they're costed. And the other issue is they do solve a problem as they did in London, but it's, you know, you need to be clear about the objectives in London. And congestion charges were part of an integrated approach to improving public transport. They improved rail and bus capacity at the same time. And also, in fact, on the day they brought in the congestion charge, they put 300 new buses into service. So, I mean, there was a huge amount of plans around making alternatives for people. I think the other thing as well about all of these discussions is it's against the backdrop of decades of poor planning, bad policy around housing. We have a situation now where housing has never been worse, whether you're renting or you're buying. We're pushing people further and further from where they want to live, where they work, where their friends or all of those things. We're actually making it worse. And when we look at the rest of Europe, we actually don't have very high car ownership, but we have huge dependency on cars. We drive more than the rest of Europe. And we have created this situation of car dependency, and we need to address why people are car dependent and not punish them for being so. And I think the problem is always framed in terms of how do we get people out of their cars? But the question is really, how do we actually reduce the time they spend travelling? That's the issue, not the cars, really.
OK, well, to the point that Geraldine's making is that, you know, it is fine if you can drive through the city centre and you can afford to pay these congestion charges, but there's an awful lot of people who are not living in, let's say, an ideal location for them in terms of the commute to work. They have to live there because of the housing crisis or other reasons. They need to be in their cars. They are car dependent, and now they're going to be penalised for that.
That's why if before I'd introduce anything like this, I'd predicate it on improving the public transport network to ensure that people have real options.
So but, do you believe, what Geraldine's saying, that you're going to have, like, we're going to see, you know, 300 buses or something rolled out and whole new...
There's about £3 billion being invested in bus connects at the moment. There's a metro that's coming to the end of planning. There's a load of stuff happening at the moment that I think if particularly the next government in the next 5 years follows it through, we'll see big progress on.
But what's the timeline on the congestion charges?
Congestion charges, this is about giving councils the ability to decide when is right for them or if it's right at all. So this isn't going to be central government saying one size fits all for every town or city around Ireland. It's going to give local authorities the ability to say, we think this is now a measure we need. Okay. Now, that could be in Dublin. That could be
so when a council... Is Dublin City Council likely to consider this?
I think that's up for the next crop of councillors to decide.
When would you like to see it considered?
I think it's something that, again, I would predicate on having an improved public transport system there. I don't think it would be a good idea for the reasons Geraldine set out to bring it in today, but I could see a point where, as they've seen in other cities where they've got great public transport, there could still be congestion.
At what point? Where's the measure? At what point do you say, right, we have got an ideal situation when it comes to our public transport, and really, if you're not taking it, you're going to be penalised for getting into your car?
It's pretty hard to put a year on that, and I'm not going to...
Right, so you're talking years. Pretend.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
We're not talking...
I don't think this is something that's coming in next. No, right. Absolutely not. But this is about giving councils the power to decide that for themselves and judge flexibly. Because I think it's reckless, excuse me, if we just simply say, this isn't an option, you can't do this. You have to give councils various different tools for them to decide for themselves.
It's up to councils to decide. And by the sounds of what Michael is saying, in Dublin City at least, it's not something that's likely to happen anytime soon, Geraldine. Would you agree that when the time is right, when we do have the public transport in place, that congestion charges will serve a purpose?
Again, I don't think congestion charges are the way forward. But I think as well we need to be realistic about the huge problem we have on our hands here in terms of reducing emissions for transport and reducing car usage. I mean, you know, bus connects and increased public transport will only go so far. If you look at somewhere like the Netherlands, they have literally world-class cycling infrastructure. They have very good public transport. Yet the majority of journeys to work are made by car. So why, when people have those options, do they not avail of them? And again, it's the same issue as what I alluded to before, which is they're making longer and longer journeys. So unless we approach transport and housing as the same issue, we can provide as many buses as we like, but we're not actually going to make any inroads on this problem, I don't think.
All right. It's an interesting one, isn't it, that we're not actually the same necessarily as London and elsewhere. No. In Ireland, in our capital cities, people have to make those journeys. And it doesn't matter how many cycle lanes you have in place and how great your bus connect system is. There will be that reliance on the car.
Sure. We're never going to be identical to any other city or any other place. We always have to make up our own mind. But we learn from those countries.
Maybe, congestion charges aren't the right thing for Ireland and Irish cities.
I think they will unfortunately probably become a necessary part, because what we have is a population that's growing, a city that's growing, but a core city centre that's remaining the same size. So since the 1980s, the number of cars has gone up by, I think it's 215%, like a huge increase. But the core city centre hasn't grown that much. It stayed the same. So if you have a problem of, even with better public transport, you've lots of alternatives, if you still just have too many cars coming in, that's going to block the buses, it's going to make it impossible to pedestrianise and make the city nice. So you're probably, at the end of all the good things that we want to do, you might need kind of, unfortunately,
Are you saying, more car parks at the perimeter of the city centre? How do you do this in a practical way if people still have to make a commute by car to certain points of their journey before they hit the city environs?
Yeah, there's an element of that. There's, to be honest, there's a lot of things you'd throw at this. One of them would be buses. One of them would be park and ride facilities, like you say, like the M3 Parkway works well. If you go to the Red Cow roundabout, particularly on a busy day, you'll see a lot of people do that. They drive there and then they get the Lewis in.
I just wonder about the cutting of carbon emissions if you're still making a chunk of your journey by car before you jump on a Lewis or a bus. We did ask you, should Irish cities introduce congestion charges to improve sustainability? And the results are in. Yes, 19% in favour of congestion charges. No, 81%. From your perspective, it seems, Geraldine, that a lot of people agree with you about congestion charges, but maybe that's because they simply don't want to have to pay up, essentially.
Yeah, look, I think people are very slow to make changes, but I think at the same time, you have to make the alternative the easier, the quickest, the most efficient. And when you do that, then people will get out of their cars and they will have options. But until you do that, we're not at a position at the moment to even consider.
How do you do that out of interest if it isn't, expanding on your public transport system and keeping fares low? What else do you do?
Yeah, but I mean, it's just availability. And it is this idea that if you go to your local train station that you can find parking. Most of them are busy by 7 o'clock in the morning. Like, there's ways around this, but it doesn't have to be always that the motorist pays.
All right, there we'll have to leave it for now. My thanks to Ger and to Michael. That is it from us. Our programme is available as a podcast on all major platforms. You can find us on Instagram and on TikTok. But from all the late team here, good night. Take care.